John, you're muted.
Hello. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going good. I'm busy.
How's your new semester?
Well, that's been going for a while, but I'm quite busy with it's NaNoWriMo month, so I'm writing another novel.
Oh my God. Oh my God, how wonderful.
And I'm off to Europe in 10 days for a conference and some field work for my novels. So
wonderful. And you just got back from Boulder.
I did. Yeah.
And that was a great event too.
It was a great event. And we're just submitting today the text that we did together. So
wonderful. I'm looking forward to reading it.
I'm very pleased with it. It's come together nicely.
Cool.
Hi, Marco.
Hey, Marco. I guess we're waiting for a few more people. There was a one that happened this afternoon, correct? A meetup?
There was. I checked in at the beginning of it, and Matteo and Tony were there.
Good.
And then I left quickly after that, so I don't know who else may have shown up.
So I expect that they won't be here tonight, since they were there this afternoon.
And it's also at 2 a.m. there.
Right.
In Germany.
Well, Douglas is here. So I guess that's everybody. Maybe Katina will join us.
Maybe.
Shall we wait a few more minutes?
Okay. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Doug.
Hey, Jeffrey, John, Marco.
Beard is filling out, Doug.
Yeah, it's the season. Tis the season, they say, right? No shave November, maybe? Yeah. I'll go with that.
I've just been totally neglecting my own facial hair. My daughter tells me, you need to shave, Dad.
I'm going on... I got a gift maybe 2 years ago that were 3 blades. So I've been using that over and over again.
Oh, the Gillette Mach 3, was it that one?
No, it was Harry's. It was one of those gift buys from somebody. So
all three of you have beards. I always found beards, it's harder to keep a beard than it is to shave. So I never saw the huge time management thing in the beards, but I guess you guys get something from it that I didn't. I did wear a beard for a while.
I tried cutting it off for a while. I couldn't stand it. I went without it for about 8 months, and then I thought, nope, I like my face with a beard, not without a beard, and I grew it back.
How long have you had a beard? Since a teenager? Or?
No, but my facial hair never grew very much. So I didn't actually develop any facial hair until in my late 20s, and I never learned to shave, so I just never did.
Oh, okay. Well, I do think it creates a sage-like sort of demeanor. I think Aurobindo had a beard too. So I think there's a trend there.
It depends on how long you let it get as to how much maintenance it requires. For me, it's really an expression of laziness because I never liked the daily ritual or the, you know, of shaving. And if you do let it get longer, then it'll get tangled and start to get annoying, but you can just trim it to get every once in a while. So I'll go 2 or 3 weeks and then I have one of those barbers, electric, plug-in machines, and I'll trim it that way. So that's all I really have to do. And It's the same with the hair. I really don't have to do very much. It's great, actually.
Well, I think we should start, guys, unless you want to share some more about facial hair.
not particularly, no. I guess it gives me a Gnostic grounding, maybe, but...
Yeah.
Well, Aurobindo tells us we have to come up out of our bodies into this sort of transcendent. So the facial hair can stay behind, you know.
Yes, that's right. You can transcend shaving or growing a beard. So why don't we meditate? And Welcome, everybody. I'm certainly glad to be here. I find this chapter a particularly intense one. I just want to start off with the first sentence. As we reach into our thought, the line at which the evolution of mind into overmind passes over into an evolution of overmind into supermind, we are faced with a difficulty which amounts almost to an impossibility. I have a little chart here. I think I showed it last time. Remember this one? In the inconscient, the subconscient, the physical, the vital, mind, higher mind, illumined mind, intuition, and we're going from overmind to supermind. So it's this transition that he's focusing attention on in this chapter, The Gnostic Being. And of course, there's overlaps between all these different levels. So I'm just going to quote him from the beginning of this chapter. At the end of that paragraph that I just started, he says, it is difficult for mental thought to understand or describe supramental nature. And then he goes on to describe this difficulty the mental has. Mental nature and mental thought are based on a consciousness of the finite. Supramental nature is in its very grain a consciousness and power of the infinite. Supramental nature sees everything from the standpoint of oneness and regards all things, even the greatest multiplicity and diversity, even what are to the mind the strongest contradictions in the light of that oneness. Its will, ideas, feelings, sense are made of the stuff of oneness. Its actions proceed from that basis. Mental nature, on the other hand, thinks, sees, wills, feels, senses with division as a starting point and has only a constructed understanding of the unity. Even when it experiences oneness, it has to act from oneness on a basis of limitation and difference. But, and it goes back to the supramental, the divine life is a life of essential, spontaneous, and inherent unity. It is impossible for the mind to forecast in detail what the supramental change must be in its parts of life action and outward behavior, or lay down for it what forms it shall create for the individual or the collective existence. But the mind acts by intellectual rule or device, or by reasoned choice of will, or by mental impulse, or in obedience to life impulse. But supramental nature does not act by mental idea or rule, or in subjection to any inferior impulse. Each of its steps is dictated by an innate spiritual vision, a comprehensive and exact penetration into the truth of all and the truth of each thing. It acts always according to inherent reality, not by the mental idea, not according to an imposed law of conduct or constructive thought or perceptive contrivance. Its movement is calm, self-possessed, spontaneous, plastic. It arises naturally and inevitably out of a harmonic identity of the truth, which is felt in the very substance of the conscious being, a spiritual substance which is universal and therefore intimately one with all that is included in its cognition of existence. A mental description of supramental nature could only express itself either in phrases which are too abstract or in mental figures which might turn it into something quite different from its reality. It would not seem to be possible, therefore, for the mind to anticipate or indicate what a supramental being shall be or how he shall act. So, I'm just a mental description of the supramental nature. I'm repeating myself here. Could only express itself either in phrases which are too abstract or in mental figures which might turn it into something quite different from its reality. So I'm going to take a risk and I'm going to try anyway. I was reading this at the library and it seems this whole chapter seems to be like a theme and theme and variations around this contrast between overmind and supermind. And on one hand it's this, on one hand it's that, on one hand it's this, on one hand it's that. It's impossible, but we're going to do it anyway. It's sort of his message here. So holding this paradox, as I was walking down the street, I saw you. Lauren is here. Hi, Lauren. So I was walking down the street, a little baffled, and sort of I was going in my head certain models that I have been exploring as I read Aurobindo, and contrasting and comparing his model with other models that I know of. And as I held this tension between the mental and the supramental, I saw this young man walking towards me, and he had a t-shirt, and I noticed on the right above his heart, it said functional pattern and very small print. And I took that as a sign, functional pattern right above the heart. I took that as a sign that I'm going in an interesting or useful direction. And I should just continue in this direction. So I could read more, and I probably will, and I hope you guys will as well, because I think there is some splendid writing in here, some very ecstatic writing. But I wanted to share with you some of these analogies that I'm trying to make between the dilemma that he offers us and functional patterns that we can observe. And I believe that there is some overlaps. We've talked about, remember that story, I think we mentioned it in the last cafe, about the crow cracking the nut. So I don't even know the original case study. I think it happened in Japan somewhere. There's a video on YouTube. I've not seen it, but I heard a description about the crow's behavior. So basically, the crow takes a nut and he puts it at the intersection at a crosswalk. And he waits for the light to change. So the cars go while the light is green, crack the nut. He waits for the light to turn red, so the traffic stops. And while the traffic is stopped, he goes down and he grabs the nut, which has been cracked open, and he eats it. So the crow is using a strategy that happens outside of time. There's nothing in an environment that connects all of these sequences. It's happening outside of time, but the crow shares with the sparrow the same environment, but the sparrow doesn't notice any of the features in the shared landscape that the crow notices. And so I've drawn a little chart, and this is drawn on, I looked at Banerjee's book, and he talks about Deleuze and the plane of consistency. I don't know if any of you guys are following Deleuze. I've read a couple of his books recently. It's not easy read, but I think I'm drawn to him because Banerjee said that the plane of consistency, he believes, is something that is very close to what Aurobindo was trying to articulate in his vision. So I hope you can bear with me and bear with my drawings here. So here's can you see this? This is the sparrow, right? And this is the plane of consistency. that the sparrow observes, and he just sees a lot of random stuff going on. Okay? And over here, I don't know if you can see this, the crow, right over here, is looking at this plane, looking at, he's connected some dots, right? He's connected all these little dots on this plane of consistency. And he's formed a sequence. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are 8 steps involved in him getting this nut crack. So what appears the same plane of consistency according to Deleuze produces different results. So the sparrow, what appears random to the sparrow becomes for the crow ordered, a sequence from which the crow derives great benefit because he can crack the nut or have the circumstances creates the conditions where the nut can get cracked because he could not do it physically, but the car running over it could. So moving from this one, so my suggestion here, oh, by the way, I failed to mention, there's another figure in this little chart. This is the man, the ornithologist, who's observing the behavior of the crow and the behavior of the sparrow. If we look at this little diagram, we have the ornithologist and the bird's world, the ornithologist can appreciate and integrate the reality of the birds. So this is a layered reality. And I think this is very sympathetic. I think Aurobindo would be very sympathetic to this idea that reality is layered. So we're looking at how, and pre-humans, before we were here, they were pre-humans who were doing this kind of stuff, who were correlating the complexity of their environments. And so this final little chart, and this is the last one, I'm just looking at the birds and the human and the cosmos and this Gnostic being. I didn't know where to put the Gnostic being. I guess you could put the Gnostic being would transcend and include the human and the birds. But these layered realities create knowledge, but it isn't a knowledge I'm coming to understand from reading this text and reading other things and some of our conversations we've had. That it emanates, but it isn't emanating from a subject. It's emanating from an encounter. And I think this is the transition from mind to supermind that Aurobindo is so he's rapturously trying to describe this transition. Because the ego mind, of course, is orchestrating things in a very narrow self-interested way. But the subliminal self, of course, and the psychic being, and I think what the Gnostic being is able to tune into many, many layers of reality that the ego mind ignores or suppresses. So is there a relationship, I wonder, between this, the Gnostic being, and what Aurobindo's calling the Gnostic being, and this chart? Very hierarchical. In this chapter, he talks about the shining ladder. And I think this is the shining ladder. So I think this idea of this Deleuzian idea of the plane of consistency and the different layers of reality from bird, human, to the cosmos, and the idea of emanation and our eurekas, those moments that we just say, oh, wow, oh, eureka, the prepared mind has a eureka when all these different elements come together and something new is created, a new reality emerges. It's just important for us to acknowledge that eureka isn't happening inside my head or inside your head. It's happening inside the cosmos. So we can, I'm using the four E's and I'm working on this. It's about enacting, enact, emerge, embed, emanate. So, I also want to give you a definition. That's the least I can do. Of Gnosticism. This is one of the most hardest words to figure out. And I've read several books on Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a modern name. I'm getting this from Wikipedia. Gnosticism is a modern name for a variety of ancient ideas and systems. These systems believe that the material world is created by an emanation from the highest God, trapping the divine spark in human body. The divine spark is liberated by gnosis, by direct knowing. So may we all be so lucky. I could read a few more. I could read several passages that I think are really splendid, but I want to sort of open up the floor to you guys and wonder how you're resonating or emanating with this chapter. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Sorry I'm late, you guys.
No problem. I just did a brief description and a few definitions. And I think I talked about the crow again. Did we talk about the crow last time? Cracking the nut? Or maybe that was a different call.
I'm not sure if I remember that.
Hi, Aura.
So, Johnny, so I got more out of your explanation than I did from the chapter itself.
Oh, God. I guess I need to start growing a beard, you know? I thought that would make everything, and get a turban, you know? And I'll start giving readings.
Quite a brilliant encapsulation of the text. I mean, there were things I liked about the text, but as always, I have my reservations as I read this. So, same reservations as I always have. So, I go through and I mark up the text and I say, oh, I have trouble with this bit. And then I add another message. I get to another passage and I say, oh, yeah, but here I'm back on board. And then I get a little bit further and I go, uh-oh. my notes on the text do this up and down roller coaster thing through his writing. So
yeah, it is a roller coaster ride for sure.
But there was a couple of texts that I wanted to read out loud. I appreciate the gnosis because I was wondering and I didn't have time to look it up. Hang on, I need to find it now. I did mark it. So one of the things I noticed was this idea that I really thought interesting, though I'm not sure that I entirely agree with it. Is this idea that a supramental being is only about being. There's no sense of... So he said being rather than knowing, which is an interesting position, if you like, on this thing. But he didn't say anything about becoming. And obviously he talks about evolution, so one could subsume the idea of becoming within his ideas of evolution. But his idea of evolution, of course, is not, it's somehow subordinate to the idea of being at the largest scale of being englobed, right, with this idea. So whereas I tend to think of becoming as the highest level rather than being. So um, anyway, I can't find the passage, but there was a passage where he talked about how the Gnostic being encompasses all of the levels of the individual. It was really beautifully said. I wish I could find it now, but anyway, maybe I'll just be quiet and allow somebody else to say, and I'll find it again.
I do believe that this captures, these charts, a logic of becoming that is sensitive to the cultural and the biological and the civilizational. I think that sometimes, because he was coming out of the 19th century, what did they have? They had Darwin, basically, and Karl Marx, and I think the materialist positivism was the rage. And we know a lot more than I think he did. But I think he did wonders with what he had, if you think about it.
Well, I love his exposition. I mean, I read this stuff and I go, I'm inspired by the argument, if you like. I mean, this huge, huge argument where he goes from the individual, he goes up all those different levels that you have in your diagram there. And there's this, I mean, the book is a massive argument in a way. I mean, obviously it's not just an argument, but there is an argument there. And I love the way it's constructed. I don't necessarily agree with it, but and I'm certainly inspired by it. You know, I can't commit to it in the way, same way that I hear other people on in the discussion sometimes doing so. But anyway, I think I'm gonna say no more for the moment. And
thank you, Jeffrey.
Waiting for Doug to jump in or somebody else, but I'd like to maybe offer a couple thoughts. I'll try not to go on too long because I'm afraid of getting lost in my thoughts if I go on too long. But I think what is most interesting to me, one of the things that's interesting to me about this chapter and about that hierarchy that that John laid out, and you put into your drawing, and that he's leading us through. This book is taking us really from the lowest rung to the highest rung, and here we are on that in that transitional phase. Is that there's also this aspect of it. Maybe it's the plane of consistency, or one aspect of that plane of consistency, where we're talking about a planetary emergence, a planetary process. So from looking at it from a scientific perspective, what we know about terrestrial evolution, this was a hot, you know, rock of molten matter, iron, all different kinds of elements. It had that material basis. And that was the predominant form. That was the predominant existent in this location. Once that cooled down, and once things in the solar system settled, you know, into some more regular habits and patterns, those orbits of the planets, and you know, the kind of clearing of debris from the immediate environment, because there were a lot of impacts of rocks and that kind of a thing upon the Earth, that allowed the conditions for life to emerge. So life, first in the form of microorganisms, and then later in the form of plants and animals and humans became the predominant form. But with humans, something different emerges, at least according to the narrative. The crow story may throw a little monkey wrench in this, but there's this new element, this new dimension of being that comes into prominence, that comes front and center. It comes from the the involved state or the potential or latent state into an actual emergence that over many thousands of years begins to form communities, tribes, larger aggregates of tribes, empires. And here we are now where in a situation where the mind is predominant. It doesn't mean that life is not present or matter is not present, but the mind is able to harness life and matter for its own objectives. And the mind is concentrated in, or what it sort of results in, the kind of person that it results in is the mental being. But we don't only have the mind, because latent in matter, life, and mind is this spiritual dimension. And that's what begins to make itself felt and make itself effective and through the psychic being, through our spiritual experiences, our paranormal experiences, dream experiences, and so forth. And that we've already passed that in this text, because now we're to the Gnostic being, which is not just spiritual in the sense of having these diversity of transmental experiences, but is grounded and rooted in an experience of oneness. So all of these different manifestations are experienced as aspects of or manifestations of that one divine Satchidananda, supermind. So supermind is interesting because, and what Aurobindo is saying here is interesting because he's trying to get around this problem of the transcendence being divorced from the immanence. The supermind embraces, takes up, enters into a deep relationship with all of the levels. So supermind is in matter and also using matter, in life and using life, in mind and using life, using mind for its own ends. And its ends are, it doesn't have ends in the sense that mental being has ends where, there's something later in time or something in some other part of space that needs to be reached or accomplished. The ends of supermind are more inherent and more infinite. They're difficult, as John, you reminded us in your introduction, for the mind in its own terms to articulate. So he's doing this anyway. And I've been reading this chapter as sort of an exercise in speculative spiritual philosophy, in a sense, because he's telling us a story of what this Gnostic being would do were it to become prominent, what it would be like, what might we expect this to be like if we follow sort of the argument, to its logical conclusions. And it seems he had some real intuitions and experiences of this in his particular context. But part of the difficulty is that it's in that particular context. And it's in, as you've brought up, John, in the ashram setting. And it's a different game in the wider world, where we're much less filtered, we're much less protected from the onslaught of those mental and vital types of energies that tend to occlude and tend to come, in Aurobindo's telling, from the ignorance. So what's great about the ashram is that it allows you to create a focused space for communing more so with the infinite and with that sense of oneness. But as I think the evolution of the discourse of in the West here, as we try to integrate mysticism into this culture, has kind of landed in, you have to be able to do it in the world. And that's, I think, the challenge that we've I'll face. And I was really inspired in this chapter, particularly by the notion of Gnostic community, a Gnostic collective, and what the principles of that would be. Like, what would a community be like where each person recognizes a common person in the diversity of their expressions? There's a lot we could explore there, I think. And there are a number of other beautiful passages as well. But I think it's a real idea kind of duality of its potential, but it has this speculative aspect, and yet we could also realize it through the practice of oneness. So that's just one to wrap it back, that plane of consistency. I'd say the difference between the mental being and the psychic or the Gnostic being is like the difference between the sparrow and the crow. And so from the Gnostic being, the same plane may appear very differently and may offer many different, you know, some different possibilities, sequences, strategies.
I just wanted to ask you a question, if I may. Something that we learned in the cafe from Gidley, I think she articulated a very similar conundrum that Aurobindo has. But she's talking about, how do we articulate new facts in a worldly context? And I think you don't have to worry about that if you're in the ashram, but I think, like you said, we have that challenge. And there's something you said about the crow throws a monkey wrench into this Aurobindo's construction, his theory making. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, where is the intelligence? Where is the higher intelligence? If it's not in the individual self, then it really happens in this wider context, in the cosmic context. And so intelligence doesn't just have to arise in the individual ego self, or it's not just in my head, like you said. And even a crow can have access to that intelligence, and can, because of its whatever mysterious power, that's kind of weird. Crows are occult beings. So we ourselves, if we locate our perspectives inside of the individual ego self, then we're going to have that kind of access to intelligence. Whereas if we are decentered and we're located in a sort of cosmic context, then we can have the intelligence of the crow and of other entities that constitute, or that we may encounter, or that in that field.
So it's the locus of the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And the capacity for all creatures to create something new, like that nut when it was cracked, that was something new that crow had created in that context. But the whole cosmos, it bifurcates the whole cosmos. I think that's really cool. And we share we're on a continuum with the animal world.
I think
that's
so
maybe
too.
That's maybe Haraway influencing me a great deal.
I think so too. And that makes the hierarchy less hierarchical.
Yes. But I think that's latent in his descriptions. He goes for that shining ladder a lot, but he gets off the beaten track quite a bit. He creates quite a few tangents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is that, he isn't consistent. But that would make sense. You can't be both consistent and complete, according to Gödel. I've said enough.
Me too.
Thank you.
I remember maybe 5 or 10 years ago reading, I think it's David Abrams, there's the spell of the sensuous and becoming animal. But those books really, at least the first few pages, you might even be talking about a crow or some bird. Actually, the cover is a crow or a blackbird, I believe. But he really creates this spell, and it takes you into what maybe our mind, or going beyond mind, what we would be like as a crow. It's as if David Abrams had that experience. So he's able to transmit that through the writing. I don't have too much else to say other than going on the sparrow, crow, the mind and supermind. I haven't really thought about it before, but I'm having almost the terminology, the language of overmind and supermind at this point might be limiting even within the writing. Just visually seeing supermind makes you think that it will be, well, it'll be my mind, but super. But it's much more than that. It's getting to the point where you do not mind in the layered sense of the word there or phrase. So I do not mind when I'm in the supermind. That's how I would put it right now.
Well, he did have this whole discussion about the impersonal versus the personal inside the chapter, which I also found very interesting because it's one of the questions that I've had all along is what is the role of personality in all of this, right? So ego is one thing, personality is not quite the same as ego. And I thought the discussion very interesting and quite, insightful, I guess, because he talks about both the personal and the impersonal both being implicate into the supermind. So in a sense, you are moving away from personality per se to something else, which has both of these characteristics of impersonality and personality. So anyway, I thought that was quite interesting. I know I sound critical of the text when I talk about it, and I have my elements where I'm not, but I also, I mean, I'm still here, guys and gals. I'm still here, what, 4 or 5 months later, reading the text. So it can't be because, you know, if I wasn't interested, I wouldn't be here, right? So so it's not that it doesn't have its effects on me. It's just that, you know, I've got a strong intellectual side, mental side perhaps, that gets stuck on issues and some of that comes out in my ways of talking about it. But I did find the text that I wanted to read. I can't give you a page number because I'm on Kindle and it doesn't know what to do with that. And I don't know what the paragraph number is. For his experience of cosmic existence will be by its form of nature and by an individualized centration, that of one living in the universe, but at the same time, by self-diffusion and extension in oneness, that of one who carries the universe and all its beings within him. This extended state of being will not only be an extension in oneness of self, or an extension in conceptive idea and vision, but an extension of oneness in heart, in sense, in a concrete physical consciousness. So I found that a very moving passage, and this idea of carrying everything. So perhaps it speaks to the experience that I had 2 or 3 weeks ago, where I had this idea of becoming part of the universe and carrying everything in the universe with it, but it speaks directly to me, that passage, in a way. So you know, as I say, there are many passages that cut through the resistances that I have, and then others where I'm sort of go, oh, right back in the midst of it. So, which tend to have to things, statements like, I don't know, so the transcendent stuff and disconnected from body, whenever we talk about that, I start to get, have difficulty with it. So Marco, you say that he's trying to reconcile the transcendent with the immanent, which I can kind of see that he's trying to do that, but I always have trouble with it when it leaves the groundedness in the body and tries to do something else with it. I have trouble following that kind of argument. So I'd be happy to listen to, I'd be happy to be tried to convince out of my resistance.
Well, I would say that's really coming out of his integration of the Vedantic side of this whole equation, and the much more predominant idea that the spiritual reality is real and the material reality is false or is an illusion, you know, that you find in that tradition, in the Hindu and Vedantic tradition. So, you know, I've not been in India personally, but my understanding is that there are religious, you know, sadhus and other kinds of yogis just wandering around. This is just a normal part of life, that you have these people who devote themselves completely to the absolute, the eternal, the infinite, you know, the transcendental, and who achieve all kinds of powers with respect to their physical bodies. So there is a denialism, a kind of even an ant in its negative expressions, as Aurobindo was arguing at the very beginning of the book. And I have to go back to the name of the chapter, the two negations, the refusal of the ascetic. There is that tendency, but there is also, you know, the distinct sense that what is real ultimately is beyond the physical form and the physical manifestation. And so that's very, very strong in his philosophy and his argument. And in a certain sense, unless we can, I think, harmonize or resonate with that perspective, then the integration won't make sense, because he argues that transcendence is necessary, that we have to remove the identity or our sense of identity from our physical being and from the material. We have to realize whatever you want to call it, a gnosis or Gnostic consciousness. But if we get stuck there, then that's actually being stuck in the overmind, because that articulation, or when a belief system or a metaphysics forms around the reality of that over and above the reality of a material universe, we end up not in this higher realization, this greater integration that is the super mind that embraces the material world. But and here's the thing, like remains predominant. Like, this is what is in Aurobindo, which I think may be difficult for us to really grapple with, is that he's really asserting the predominance of that supermental being. Like, that he's asserting that just as we have this mental civilization that's, you know, taken over the planet, he's just imagining a supermental Gnostic truth, you know, consciousness based on that unity perception, actually becoming predominant, actually becoming the forefront, or the obvious normal reality. That's what is, I think, really the visionary and the radical component of this, is that, I mean, imagine taking everything we know, our politics, our economics, our modes of, family and friendship and social organization, take all of that, and instead of having it be based on our biology, instinct, vital mental formations or concepts, it rather is reflective of and expressive of that spiritual principle. But that's what he's saying is coming. You know, that's what he sees as the destiny or the telos of this process that we're in. And he wonders at the end of this chapter, interestingly, whether that is limited to the earth, or it can sort of, is this a limited pocket where that can happen, or does it extend to the rest of the universe? You know, will any kind of Gnostic community still be subject to these forces of the ignorance, you know, or can it establish a kind of greater hegemony? He doesn't use that word, but that seems to be kind of what the science fiction edge of this is. My strategy, I shared this with Matteo and Marco, the other Marco, last week. My strategy reading this has been to make believe that I know exactly what he means. So I just assume the Gnostic consciousness is real, and that all of these things that he's describing about it and the way that it would operate and kind of reconfigure everything, that sure, let's go with that. I like that, actually. It seems, even if it's not metaphysically true, because I think there is this speculative streak here, it does submit really interesting things, you know, like to feel that, well, perhaps we could reorganize the world. And what would that mean? It's generative, let's say, at least. That's how I'm experiencing it. And so I'm curious about where you feel the resistance, because those may be points that are, you know, they contain some energy, they contain some potential to be explored.
Thank you for that. That was really, again, I'm going to have to listen to the episode again, this episode after, in order to catch some of these arguments. I mean, I agree with you. I agree with Aurobindo in terms of the vision of where things are going. I just don't agree with all of his steps to get there. You know, it's more on ways and means that I have issues than on final ends, in a way. You know, it's sort of, I have an argument on inconsistency, but I guess I can whip myself my way around that. But this whole argument on evolution, I have trouble with evolution and involution. We've talked about this before. It seems to be a closed universe, and I tend to be, my fundamental belief is that the universe is open, not closed. And so, and the whole involution argument is based on an idea of a closed universe. If you know, you have to wrap everything up inside everything in order to be able to unwrap it later. Because in a closed universe, no other solution is possible. But in an open universe, you can generate new things during the so-called unwrapping stage, and you don't need to involve everything down, all the way down. So, but is that a fundamentally different understanding of the cosmos than Aurobindo, or is it an update of Aurobindo based on what we know about science today? And if it's an update, then what do we need to change in our understanding of Aurobindo's project in order to get to something that is more coherent with current understanding of science? And that's where I'm a little bit you know, where I think there's a possibility there in terms of, but I don't know how to do that. But it's part of my thinking and critical aspects about this process, right? The evolution argument, of course, is this idea that progress is directed, that there's a direction to it. But of course, as we know, modern science, Darwin believed that, but I don't think in today's understanding of evolution, we believe that evolution is directed. I mean, it comes back to the Gebser argument about mutations, right? It's more a question of mutation than evolution and mutation. So this whole argument that consciousness is somehow more important than other aspects of life, again, those are things I have trouble with in the Aurobindo formulation of things, this idea of higher and lower, you know. But again, is it that I disagree with the whole project, or is it a way of rethinking certain aspects of Aurobindo to get to something that is more coherent with my understanding? That's where I struggle with, you know, where I don't know. But and I know that that's a very intellectual thing, you know, somehow. But the problem is it's not just intellectual. It's grounded in something deep within myself that can't accept a closed universe, can't accept a directed orientation, you know? So it's not just the intellectual exercise is the effort to try and reconcile Aurobindo with my deep beliefs of things. There's an intellectual exercise there. But the deep beliefs in things is not an intellectual exercise. It's something else. So I don't know what the answer is to all that.
Well, I think the crow and the bird, they both share an environment, a plane of consistency. But what to the bird is just white, the sparrow is just white noise. To the crow is an ordered pattern. So it does seem, and I'm sure that the sparrow has ability to detect some patterns that it wouldn't survive. So I think this people, the more people there are who are detecting patterns, there are going to be more patterns to observe. And I think that the kinds of patterns that Aurobindo seems to be operating with are when he goes from the inconscient to the overmind or the supermind. I think he's going into the inner. He's exploring interior space, and that's where I'm backtracking a little bit. I apologize for my confused remarks here, but you talked about the personal and the impersonal, and he's talking about this in this brief couple of sentences. Here we are on Earth. And yet it is supposed that the ego personality is extinguished and replaced by a universalized spiritual individual who is the center and power of the transcendent being. It might be deduced that this Gnostic or supramental individual is a self without personality, an impersonal Purusha. There could be many Gnostic individuals, but there would be no personality. All would be the same in being and nature. This again would create the idea of a void or a blank of pure being from which an action and function of experiencing consciousness would arise. But without a construction of differentiated personality, such as that which we now observe and regard as ourselves on our surface. But this would be a mental rather than a supramental solution of the problem of a spiritual individual surviving ego and persisting in experience. And he goes on to he seems to make a distinction. He ends up on one side of it. He goes to the other side of it, and then he returns to that side of it. But he never seems, he seems to imply that he's going to go to another level and integrate them. But I'm not quite sure that he pulls this off. But I do think if you look at this, I think I showed you this chart too of the psychic being in the center. The Purusha is the person. Prakriti is nature. So Prakriti is dealing with the outer vital, physical, mental. Purusha, the person, is dealing with the inner physical, vital, mental. And then the psychic being is in the center. I think the psychic being and the Gnostic being are pretty much the same thing. But there's more than one just psychic being. I mean, we are potentially all Gnostic beings. So I think that's where the novelty and the nuance and the capacities to emanate in interesting ways can never be exhausted. So I wouldn't say that he's coming from a closed system. Just like the crow experiences infinity, so does the sparrow. They both are experiencing infinity, but they're different kinds of infinity. So that's why I think that those layered realities between the inner and the outer and the inner and the psychic being and the contact that we make with other psychic beings and even with other animals, I believe would give us endless possibilities. But I think the challenge we have now is our focus is so narrow, and it seems the ego has constrained us to the point where we're spending all of our resources monetizing, you know, water, the air we breathe, anything that can be monetized. They try to, our culture is just devoted to monetizing nature. And I think that's going to stop real soon, whether we want it to or not. So I would think there are other ways of us to derive satisfaction. And I believe this is one of the maps that we can draw on to support that possibility. So anyway, I hope that made some sense.
I'm wondering if Jeffrey maybe could go in a little bit more about exactly what you mean by open and closed system. Like, do you mean in the sense of like matter can't be created or destroyed, like it only transforms and that's a closed system? So that's kind of how I see it, almost like it's like, you like you were saying, like it loops around on itself, like it's all wrapped up in this neat package. But it's almost like to me, I see it like in each and every moment there is new creation, but it's like recycling energy constantly at the same time. And it's hard to even imagine each and every moment, because we're talking about faster than you could even imagine each and every moment is, you know. I don't think that there really, to me, it doesn't make sense that there was a beginning and there will be an end. And then that, again, like you, I don't like the linear idea of things. I think that things are all kind of happening at once in some sense of it. And yet, as much as it seems like opposite, it does appear like there is some sort of direction, maybe not all one way focused, but like that there's like many currents, you know, and that like if you think about it like the ocean, like there's all these currents, and like think about the freaking trash piles. That's a good way to like see where the currents lead, and they all will like clump into certain areas depending on the terrain, whatever. And maybe I could see it like that, like that there's certain waves, and I mean, you might even be able to call them timelines. Like, I swear I'm living in a completely different world than some people on this planet. And like, not just world, like timeline, like the way that I see the world happening is totally different than the way that somebody else sees the world happening. And is that just our like mental creation, or is that part of our psychic being where we're picking up on some of these directions that we're evolving to? I also feel like the word of evolution is challenging for us because it does limit us, and people already have a preconceived notion about what that means. And for all we know, Aurobindo could have had a sense of that word that was more open and fluid, and it wasn't a one single directional kind of thing. I mean, the super mental could be achieved in so many different ways, and express itself in different ways for each and every one of us. And again, we're still seeing that, like, we are ultimately these psychic beings in the middle of it, but we're everything too. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but.
That was lovely, Lauren. And yes, yes. To everything you said. I certainly don't think about it as matter. I must admit that I am strongly influenced by Whitehead's ideas about this. So Whitehead, in his philosophy, talks about, well, he talks about different processes because it is a process philosophy, but he talks about, we've talked about prehension, which is about the way things influence each other. But he also talks about this idea called concrescence, which is not the same as concretion, which we often talk about in other contexts. This idea of concrescence is the coming together of what he calls novelty. And so it's the emergence of new possibilities in the universe, if you like, that come together. And that's kind of what I mean by being open-ended, is this idea of that everything isn't already fixed into place. I'm not quite saying that Aurobindo thinks this, but this sort of idea of involution, where everything gets rolled up into itself, and so it can be unfolded as an evolutionary process in the other direction, seems to imply that all of the unfoldings are in some sense already there. And so it seems like the idea of novelty in a completely new sense isn't, you know, it could be there, but it's not, doesn't seem to be there in the way Aurobindo formulates it. But one of the things that fascinates, it's one of the reasons why I so like Debashish Banerjee's ideas, is because he understands Aurobindo at levels way, way beyond anything I will ever achieve in my lifetime. But he does so in this way where he sort of understands that one has to update some of these ideas. And he has very interesting ideas about how they should be updated, based on actually very deep understanding of what modern physics or modern science in different ways have done. And so so I'm not closed to the, you know, I think you could have, you could mix this idea of evolution with an idea of novel creation and maybe get something a little bit different from what Aurobindo laid out, but would still be within the spirit of what he laid out, you know? So, and I agree with you, multiple timelines, it's a silly little thing, but I was just watching, season 3 of The Good Place. I don't know if anybody is watching that. It's about hell and heaven, and these people are trying to navigate between hell and heaven. And so this episode calls time in hell and heaven, he calls it Jeremy Beamery. Why does he call it Jeremy? And he draws it, so he says, well, time in the regular space is a line like that, but in hell and heaven, it does all these squiggles. And when you look at the squiggles afterwards, it spells Jeremy Beamery. But it's this idea that you know, you can have a lot of things happen in hell, but no time passes on earth while it's doing. So that's, anyway, it's a silly little argument, but it's related to what you said about time, and it can be much more convoluted than the sort of linear, anyway.
It just reminded me of a Grateful Dead lyric where he says, such a long, long time to be gone and a short time to be there. And it's in reference to the song's Box of Rain, and Box of Rain is supposed to be the earth and where our timeline or whatever. And I think of it like when we're not conscious, like maybe between birth and, or between death and rebirth, like we're gone such a long, long time, like because time is completely different in that realm, perhaps. And it's such a short, seems at least relatively, like such a short time to be here when we know about how long, say, this planet alone has been here. But of course, I mean, all of that is speculative too. Like, we don't really know how long ago anything formed. We're just guessing about time. Have any of you guys seen this little, like, 12-year-old kid who's, like, a physicist, and he talks about time and multiple dimensions and universes and all this stuff? He's just, he'll blow your mind. Like, I don't know exactly what to look up to find him on YouTube, but
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, and he's, like, talking about how, like, there's this, like, in one way, everything has happened already. Like, but, like, in each and every moment, like everything, anything is possible. There's an infinite amount of possibilities. And so it's funny to say that like everything has happened already, yet it's infinite. And so there still is the possibility of new creations. I'm familiar with Whitehead as well. I took some classes with Eric Weiss at CIS. And yeah, so like it's interesting to think that there can be new creations, and yet like every possibility may already be out there, like, but there's infinite possibilities, and yet things are still like limited, you know. I mean, I can't turn into a unicorn right now. Maybe in some universe and timeline I can. But you know, that's kind of how he talks about it, like each timeline or dimension is like these little slivers like next to each other, like in this, it's so hard to even really imagine, put it into any mental way of describing it, because it's beyond the mental once we get into the realm of time and space freedom and moving around in infinite possibilities.
I shared previously, I think it was on Monday at the cafe, I talked, maybe I don't remember, but I had this experience last week. I was practicing my yoga, my dream yoga, and I was working with the energy centers, and I started to float out of the body. And this is very clunky vocabulary, by the way, but I don't know what else to use. And then I found myself in this room, but there was no ceiling. And it was a lot of light, and I was at a conference table, and I was talking to this other people, and I said, well, you know, I've been doing this Vajrayana practice, and I'm able to raise the energy up my spine and have this experience with you today. You know, I was giving this little talk to this audience in this other dimension, and it feels just like I'm talking to you guys. I mean, it was just sort of ordinary. And I mentioned that I had this probably was due to the fact that I had a past lives in China and in Japan. And then other things happened. And then I returned to conventional physical arrangements. And I thought about that. And I realized my ego, the outer self, has no access to any past lives in Japan or China. But the psychic being has access to that. And that's what I often find, that these experiences of the psychic being and the outer self can be integrated perhaps by some individuals who are much more advanced than I am, that's for sure. I don't feel like I've integrated very much, but the little I have, I sort of appreciate where I think Aurobindo's coming from. Because I think that our brains are basically, this is not a new idea. I think it comes out of, it's a filter. It's basically a valve to keep out more, you know, most of what's happening. So it narrows us down so that we can have this physical experience. But our psychic being isn't trapped to the extent that this physical being is in these constraints. But these constraints also enable certain features that can be worked with. And I think something new and novel comes out of that. So I'm just saying I don't know exactly what I'm saying, but I think these kinds of experiences can blow a fuse and create depression and psychotic responses, or they can help a person modulate that, what he's calling the vital and the mental. But I do think he neglects the lower chakras. And I believe this is what those of us who've gone through drugs, sex, and rock and roll, we know there's much more going on than just the here and up here. And I think the descent is fine, but I think we should, I'm drawing upon Jorge Ferrer, who's written a book, I think, on the participatory turn, and he sort of, he compares mystical experiences from many different traditions, and he believes something new is happening among all of us who practice from different traditions. Like, I'm not a Buddhist, but I've done Buddhist practice for 20, 30 years, and I've been initiated in certain practices. So, but I wouldn't call myself a Buddhist. And I think that's that post-religious spirituality, I think, is creating new kinds of configurations. But I think the root and the sex center cannot be, I think, ignored. And I believe Aurobindo does. I think he was sort of sex phobic, and he doesn't explore that the dark side of Tantra at all, for very political reasons, I'm sure. But I think that many of us who have gone through, you know, the postmodern phase, and we're still in it to some extent, we're not that constrained. And I don't think we're so sex phobic. And I think we're pretty open-minded about a lot of things that I think he came from a very formal kind of, you know, Cambridge and the Sorbonne or wherever, and the ashram. He was a very formal kind of person. So I think we're not constrained that way. And that's where I think the cutting edge is in those lower chakras, because there's a lot of energy flowing through those chakras right now. And I'm not, and you know, at first it's like, whoa, you know, but I think it's like the more we can work with that without trying to privilege one chakra over the other with this top-down kind of model, I think the healthier and happier and more creative we're going to be in the environments and the worldly context that we find ourselves in. But I think the challenge is, how do we express these new facts in a worldly context? Because we don't have the vocabulary for it. I don't think Aurobindo had the vocabulary for it either in his time. So it's a big, big challenge. For us, how does one psychic being communicate to another psychic being in this within the constraints of our, this outer world, the necessary constraints, which also enable us.
I'll just pick up on that. The one place where in my notes, the margin notes, I wrote "bah" is kind of around this issue of how is a personality, how is our, who becomes a Gnostic being? What does that look like? This, I didn't number the paragraphs, so this is about halfway through the chapter. But he talks, I'm going to read it. A supramental Gnostic individual will be a spiritual person. Okay, so P, capital P, person. This is a term that he's introduced just prior. The person is the Purusha. It's the pure consciousness that takes on or becomes involved in all the different forms, all the different manifestations. The person is there all along. I think that's an important thing to grasp, is that the person is there even in matter. It's just completely trapped, as it were. And it's the person, it's the conscious being that's actually working out these different forms in order to have, in order to experience a freedom of movement and a fullness of expression. So something about the metaphysics, it's not that there's just matter and then sometime later consciousness comes, sometime later person, a personhood evolves, that person is there. But through the evolution process, person experience, the person, the Purusha experiences him herself as all these different gradations of being. And we do have an experience of individuality through that, but our first experiences of individuality are egoic and mental, and they have to do with our, a narrative self of, you know, a composite of all the different experiences we've had, memories, ideas about the past, the future, our timelines are part of that, our egoic personalities. But then he writes, a supramental Gnostic individual will be a spiritual person, but not a personality in the sense of a pattern of being marked out by a settled combination of fixed qualities, a determined character. He cannot be that, since he is a conscious expression of the universal and the transcendent. So we do have personalities that if you can fix and determine who you are, that's an egoic personality. But neither can his being be a capricious, impersonal flux, throwing up at random waves of various forms, waves of personality as it pours through time. I think this is more of the oceanic, the kind of chaotic unconscious, that just, you know, flux and flow of different kinds of possibilities. So it's not that either. Something like this may be felt in men who have no strong centralizing person in their depths, but act from a sort of confused multi-personality according to whatever element in them becomes prominent at the time. But the Gnostic consciousness is a consciousness of harmony and self-knowledge and self-mastery, and will not present such a disorder. That's where I put the ba. It's because I don't know who has such an orderly kind of personness. Everybody I know and every guru I know or have ever known or known of is kind of messed up at the level of personality. So I think that this is one of those areas where there's maybe an ideal of this self-contained, this perfectly equanimous, this perfectly serene, this perfectly awake and ecstatic and infinite being. But the reality of our experience is a lot messier than that. And we may have aspects of ourselves that, you know, we may get our act together in various ways and integrate the supramental. But I think this is where it's still speculative, and this is where it still has a kind of an idealism, which I also resist, because that's, I experience myself as being a lot messier than he describes. And if that's the case, then if I were to believe that personhood or Gnostic being can only be achieved by, you know, these pristine, you know, these pristine souls, I would just be among the damned forever. There would be no hope. So I think we have to make a little more room for the personality and for the messier aspects and the more open-ended and kind of ragged aspects of the experience that we're having. And at the same time, you know, like what gets involved, like there's something, Jeffrey, like just to respond to that point of the like you want to maintain an open system, but can you get outside of the universe? Can you get outside of being? Like one, if there's something rather than nothing, can you get to there not being something? So that somethingness is part of the sameness that is involved in being from the beginning, and you know it's infinite, so it can't be limited to particular formations. But the thing that's infinite is still not, it's still sort of an absolute. So that's a difficulty for sure, because you know any absolute that we can articulate is not the absolute absolute, to paraphrase another spiritual text that we know. So can you have that openness and at the same time, you know, we're damned to being in a certain way, and that's part of the impetus to work things into another condition, you know, that maybe is more favorable to the kind of way that we want to be. If I may throw out one more point and then I'll shut up, is like, let's say a race of Gnostic beings evolved and they were able to control matter and to create a universe like the Gnostic philosophy actually, you know, maintains. Maybe they would involve some kind of pattern or game to be played out, or some kind of like who that's where it gets it. I don't know, kind of in weird is when you think, when we start to consider like where did the structures and rules that seem to be evolving, you know, through history, where do they really come from? They may not just be a expression of sort of from below, a kind of matter turning into life, turning into this. It could also be that consciousness has been around for a long, long time and is at consciously working out different scenarios to, you know, for its own entertainment or whatever. And so we find ourselves in the midst of that, sort of trying to remember what it was that set this all off. And in the end, we'll find it was, in some sense, ourselves, because we've been here before and been doing this for a long time.
Sounds like you're talking about aliens and shit. Like, coming in, forming, you know? I mean, some sort of race that's evolved to is creating new worlds, and there's plenty of theories that's where we came from, and that we're just kind of starting the process all over again. One thing that kind of like sticks out to me, maybe it's just because I'm like so focused on it right now in my life with trying to heal my son's skin problem, but I feel like we're not going to be able to evolve our consciousness or whatever you want to call it until we're able to detoxify ourselves and live in a more harmonious way with the planet.
Don't do real one.
I think it's going to be really hard to get there when we're full of toxins that create depression and all these different imbalances and sicknesses. And, you know, I think that there's a really important, like, level on the material side of things that really needs to be addressed. And it's in the same light as what you're talking about, John, with acknowledging the lower chakras. Like, that's our earth, our body, our taking care of ourselves like that. That is like so basic. And we need to acknowledge that and heal that. Otherwise, how are we expecting to integrate all of ourselves with the universe? It just, it feels like there's a huge roadblock there.
I don't
a lot of people are in denial about it. You know, you start trying to talk to someone about removing certain toxins from their life and they go, oh God, shut up. Like, that's not that big of a deal. You know, like, you're crazy. I'm somehow a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist just because I think we need to get poisons out of our lives. But, you know, I think that's just a really important part that, again, Aurobindo doesn't really talk about that. Maybe that's something that's more really of concern to us now than it was then. So a lot of people were excited about things like plastics and whatnot, didn't really consider the consequences of those choices. But then there are other people who were totally sinister and just pushed it upon us, knowing how bad it was, and are continuing to do that today. So we have a lot of forces to contend with. Hi. Hi, guys.
He's developing a voice, right?
He's got quite the voice.
See you, guys.
Yeah.
See you.
I was going to, I don't know, Ellie. I do think there's this, I think it was Carrie Welch who said that, you know, there's that public world that's objective and that we share. And with lots of linear sequences that we've mastered. And then there's the inner world, but she says nobody lives there. We live in an inner, messy, nonlinear, psychic world. And it's, so how can we make these transitions from this nonlinear, inner, psychic to this outer, very linear kind of sequence? And I think we need to do both. But I do believe, this is coming from a belief rather than something that I know, but I think beliefs for me are transitional states. So I use as if, I act as if I believe something and see what happens. And then I reject some beliefs and they drop out of my system. But I think that using that as if frame is very helpful. And I think our artists and our storytellers and our movie makers exploit this. And I think they're tapping into something that could be true. And I believe there is that psychic being who is not constrained as the outer being is. They have fast forwarded and figured it out and is communicating to us in altered states and different ways of knowing, certain themes, motifs, sensations, flashes that we then, the outer self, can orchestrate new behaviors around that, around those experiences, what I would call trance, evolutionary trance states, very heightened learning states. And some of these may be in our culture, you know, we talk about UFOs and extraterrestrials or aliens. And these just may be mythical ways of making sense of these kinds of experiences. And I suspect that these kinds of experiences are not that uncommon. They're just not reported, except maybe in very close circles. But there are weird, very weird things going on this planet. And Jeffrey Kripal, he's a religious professor at Rice University, has written quite a few books on them. And I believe if we started paying attention to these kinds of experiences, which he, you know, focuses his research on, you know, I believe we would start to, you know, the outer world would be a lot more permeable. So anyway, that would be my hope. But I think that one of the myths that I like is that idea that these extraterrestrials whose civilization has collapsed, they're coming to us. They are our future. We are their past. And they're communicating to us in these pseudo orientations in time. This is what you need to do. we will give you this knowledge, but we can't give it to you unless you take it from us, because you have to be actually smarter than we were when we were you back then. So, and I believe a lot of this telepathic stuff that's happening is about these imprints, and that we're getting re-imprinted. And I think matter needs to be prepared for these imprints. I don't believe in these platonic forms just stamping their reality on matter. I think that matter has to be prepared to receive any of this. And I believe that's what we're doing in these outer cells. And I believe Aurobindo was intuited this too when he talks about divinizing matter, that the more we pay attention to these many phases of consciousness, that gets into our psyche and our soma, and we can, in our communications to one another, create these, this emanation starts to, these sparks happen between these psychic beings that we all are. So I know this is far-fetched, but hey, why not, you know? I think we need to use our imaginations in a creative and healthy way rather than get trapped into these neoliberal bourgeois fantasies that are going to lead us nowhere really fast.
I think you would like listening to Laura Eisenhower. She's the great granddaughter of President Eisenhower. And she's like all about disclosure of alien stuff. And it's pretty deep. She calls herself she's got a lot of different ways of describing herself, but one of them is like a galactic historian or something. And so she goes into a lot of that stuff about this, potentially like the grays or other aliens. Honey, stop. But the basically one idea was that they want to save themselves from the destruction that they did on themselves.
Hey, honey, you need to stop so I can talk.
But so that they, if they...
No!
If they solved their problems, they would cease to exist. So they don't really want to solve their problems. So like you said, you have to take it from them, almost, if you believe in this. It's fun to toy around with the idea, at least. And sorry about Arlo screaming.
So yeah, I enjoy it. Yeah, you mentioned, I can't remember if it's Lauren Eisenhower, but yeah, you mentioned her a while back, or someone did, and yeah, I checked her out, and it is kind of in the science fiction realm that definitely not a presidential candidate in our world that we live in right now, but she had some good ideas. But I might take it back to the imaginal realm. I don't want to try to influence Jeffrey, but I didn't chime in earlier, and I know you mentioned Dune, the Dune series, as being one of your main influences. And is it Paul Atreides? The main character. But he, in a sense, is maybe an example of an image, an imagination of what a Gnostic being could be. And possibly a Gnostic community. I don't remember the story completely, but just like in a lot of science fiction stories, there's a developing of what can be, and he comes across, I guess he's initiated into a certain culture, and they have the spice, which can be interpreted in many different ways, but it's in a sense that's the messy knowledge that takes you into that strange realm. But kind of lost a lot of the other threads I wanted to tie together there, but I don't know. Maybe that's your personal story, Jeffrey, that you use for how you go about the world as one of your greatest influences. And all these these books are physical emanations of something that can't be explained, but they do provide some language. I remember listening to the audio version while doing my work, since I frequently drive certain days. I'll have hours at a time to listen to audio, and that book really sucked me in. The part where he had, I guess, one of the initial parts when he's placing his hand inside this box, that he essentially has his hand mutilated and burning on fire, or the ultimate pain, when really there's probably nothing going on in the box. Maybe multi-layered definition of what our journey into the unknown is, and he's able to kind of pull through. Even I can't remember if he was told no, there's nothing going on here, so be strong, explain it to me again. But
he had to put his hand in the box. He was told that there was a poison needle, that if he tried to pull his hand out, he would be jabbed with the needle and he would die. So he had to keep his hand in the box.
Okay.
But the box gave him neurological pain, extreme neurological pain. So, and the argument that was given was that an animal, when faced with that pain, would pull the paw out and face the consequence of dying. But a human could overcome the pain and keep that. And so it was a test to see whether or not he was human.
Right. So my interpretation is obviously taking it out of proportion, but it was kind of my metaphor for just staying with the trouble, going past this human life into something else. But obviously that's not what it's about. But
well, maybe. I would have said Paul Atreides isn't the right character, but his son, Leto II, is the main character of the book called God Emperor of Dune, which is the fourth book in the series. And his son has his body converted, and he becomes essentially a kind of worm, like if you know the Dune, the worm things. And he lives for 10,000 years in order to try and help humanity organize itself better. So he's probably more the character that you're thinking of than Paul himself. So I recommend that book if you keep going with the series. I would highly recommend that book.
This is sort of getting more and more nonlinear for me. I'm just looking at this passage about the person is larger than his personality. And it may happen that this inner largeness overflows into the surface formation. The result is a self-expression of being which can no longer be described by fixed qualities, normalities of mood, exact lineaments, or marked out by any structural limits. I remember, this was quite a while ago, I was watching on TV with a friend who was very ill. He was actually the last phase of an illness. So there, I know if you've ever taken care of people who are close to death, there's an atmosphere. And I remember Marcus was lying down, and I was lying down next to him, and I was watching TV, and there was a concert. It was a Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello, playing Rachmaninoff cello sonata. And as in sort of the middle of the performance, I had a flash of Leonard Bernstein, and I felt like he was right there, and I said out loud, I said, I wonder what's happening with Leonard Bernstein. And the next day, I'm reading the New York Times, and it mentioned that Leonard Bernstein died of a heart attack while listening to Yo-Yo Ma play Rachmaninoff's sonata. On Sunday, and this was on the Monday that I read the paper. And so I thought, oh, okay. Because I loved Leonard Bernstein. I'd listened to all of his recordings when I was young. so I'd sort of grown up on him as this great musical educator. Then I remember I was in a cafe talking to some friends, and there was a pause in the conversation, and somehow, out of nowhere, I said, you know what pisses me off about Mother Teresa? And I gave this long argument about, you know, the church and loving the sinner, but not the sin. And I was really so offended by some of that. And I just blurted it out from nowhere. And I looked at the clock on the wall and said 3 o'clock. And I got home that night and I found out that she had died at 3 o'clock that afternoon, right when I was like cursing her out. And of course, I burst into tears because I love Mother Teresa. But that doesn't mean you can't have problems with people that you love. But I think Mother Teresa and Leonard Bernstein were sort of examples of people who are larger than life. And they were plugged into something, to a very large current, but it came through, you know, this person. And they had roles and they had functions and they had certain skill sets and they had certain politics that you might disagree with. But I also just want to read one little thing. Before we go, I know it's getting close. There's this one paragraph about ecstasy and peace, which I thought was really perfect. He says, "It has been held that ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of the supreme is the supreme realization, the consummate abiding experience. This may be true on the spiritual mind plane. There, the first ecstasy felt is indeed a spiritual rapture, but it can be and is very usually mingled with the supreme happiness of the vital parts taken up by the spirit. There is an exaltation, excitement, the highest intensity of the joy of the heart, and the pure inner soul sensation that can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. But in the highest ascents of the spiritual bliss, there is not this vehement exaltation and excitement. There is instead an illimitable intensity of participation in an eternal ecstasy, which is founded on the eternal existence and therefore on a beatific tranquility of eternal peace. Peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one." I just think that it's gorgeous. And I think that if you can ride him when he gets into these exalted states, I believe he can be a kind of catalyst for awakening that psychic being.
That passage also speaks to the issue that came up at the Gebser conference, the paper on Gebser's encounters with Eastern philosophy and Zen in particular, and his dialogue with Suzuki Roshi, where they're discussing his experience of Satori, and Suzuki is confirming that this is Satori that he's experienced and not Samadhi, because Samadhi is that ecstasy. Samadhi is the trance state or the particular state experiences. But Satori is that peace. It's the, you know, that is the gnosis. That's what's cool about this, is that you get Samadhi and Satori, you know, really unified or transcended and included, or however you want to put it. I like that better.
I would say they're co-specifying. I think they're pointing to one another.
Yeah, I like that better than kind of dismissing Samadhi for Satori or you know, whatever.
They're emerged and embedded, emanating from each other. I did some fun doodles while we were talking, but this one was cool. I like this little eye or something.
Can you show that to me again? What is it?
Sure.
Yeah, hold that up.
It looked like the crow for a second. Oh, yeah.
Let's start. It looks like it was this way that it started.
Oh, okay.
Speaking of the crow, I had a little anecdote to talk
So it's another reading from Isley. I don't know, does anybody read Lauren Isley? He's a naturalist who writes about interesting encounters with animal species. And it's from a very kind of mystical, almost philosophical kind of way. Anyway, so he has a story about a man who encounters a crow. So he goes into the story, he describes the world as the crow sees it, you know, air, trees, you know, housetops, you know, and that's about it, you know, and other crows, right? So, because the crow is flying along at these heights, right? And then he describes the man and what the man sees. Well, you know, it's fences and it's stores and, you know, cars or whatever it's, right? And then there's a big fog and the man meets the bird and they are confronted with each other. And of course, each is completely discombobulated by the experience because the man doesn't expect to meet a bird and the bird doesn't expect to meet a man. They are normally at very different heights. And so they have very different worlds. But in this particular occasion, the bird has gotten lost in the fog and is at the level of the man. And so they meet. So it's not unrelated to your question of the plane of consistency, but it's another take on that, if you like.
I have not read who you're speaking of, but I'm very much into like animal messengers, I guess you could say, understanding archetypal messages that an animal can send you when you see them. Like I have particular animals that when they show up, it's like certain things that means to me. And I think that's like part of the experience for me, at least, of like integration and experience and bliss and peacefulness is like I'm seeing this cohesion or something with the universe and things seem to be flowing and I'm getting the right messages and I'm giving my thanks for it too. I think that's something that's actually really important. My friend had this story of riding along with a Native American friend of his in a car and they're like on some desert highway and all of a sudden a coyote runs across their path and his friend pulls over the truck real quick and like gets out and he does a little prayer and offers some tobacco and my friend's like, was that really necessary? Like, couldn't you just like give him a little prayer as you drove by or something? And he's like, no, you don't understand. this is how you do it. I don't believe you have to be that extreme, but I do believe that like there is an importance in acknowledging things that come along to us and that helps us be present and in a state of bliss that's peaceful and just like that passage you read, John. I thought that was beautiful as well.
I'll post a couple of references to him on the site if you like, Lauren. You'd like his books if you like that kind of thing. He wrote one called The Night Country, which is, he's an American naturalist, a very, very interesting man. And he always writes from the point of view of the animals, which is always so interesting. So The Night Country is maybe probably one that you'd like.
I think that this is one of the messages of this chapter, one of the messages I'm getting from this, from Aurobindo, and this idea of divinizing matter, that part of what Supermind wants to do, like what it's up to, if you want to look at it that way, is creating the conditions for itself to have a world. and to be able to exist in this multiplicity and this diversity of infinite intelligence in embodied reality. And like when you talk about the toxic and everything that we're doing wrong with respect to our material and our environmental substrate condition, I think that these are all ways that we constrict the possibilities, like that we downgrade really the possibilities of our being. Like, I think that if we had healthier relationships, ecologically, socially, and in all ways, I mean, in a way it would make things more boring because we wouldn't have to deal with a lot of crap that we have to deal with now, but it would also open up just untold possibilities because we wouldn't have to deal with all the crap that we have to deal with now. Like if my body is not trying to process some kind of heavy metal or some kind of industrial, you know, pesticide or whatever it is, then that's that much more resources that are available for this kind of super conscious experience coming through the body. That is, I don't think that that means that we're for, you know, for that, that we can't have spiritual experiences because there are toxins in our environment. I mean, I think that that's a mixture of, I don't think it's limited. And that's one of the, you know, that's one of the things that we can also, I think.
Yeah, learn. No, I don't think it's totally limited. But I do think it can, like you're saying, like it devotes your attention to something else. Like it's like somebody constantly interrupting you when you're in the middle of trying to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you can't focus on, yeah, exactly. You can't focus on what you're doing, you know? You can't devote your energy towards that kind of evolution of your consciousness if your body is constantly ailing you and you're sick and you can barely get out of bed or whatever it may be. It puts a big mountain in front of those people who are extremely sensitive to it, particularly. But I think it also is just like dampened everyone's consciousness. I mean, look at how much people are just sheep in this country, particularly. Like, I mean, it's sad. It's sad, really. But I do think that there's possibilities beyond that. If we didn't have this toxic burden to deal with, I mean, think about the potential that people, I mean, I know so many amazing people that are burdened by their sicknesses or whatever. They could be doing so many better things, but instead they're sitting there focusing on getting better.
Yeah.
But of course it doesn't limit their ability to have a spiritual experience. I think it's more almost that it limits their ability to like act that into the world, like be an active participant with that. You know, if you're stuck in that sickness.
I think it's a great point.
I don't know.
No, I think that's actually really a great point. And that's one of the things that's not really emphasized in this book. The environmental movement didn't exist when Aurobindo was writing this. So, I mean, there was concern for war and for economic, all kinds of issues, but that wasn't in the awareness.
The Indian Supreme Court struck down sodomy laws last month. That's a huge shift in consciousness for this planet. So a lot of good things have happened since Aurobindo's passing, and he may have created conditions for that, for what we're reaping the benefits from now. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but that just
came
through. Wonderful things are happening, like the environmental movement, the civil rights movement, women's liberation, men's liberation. I think the postmodern, for all of its successes, has achieved considerable benefits for all of us.
Yeah, I agree, and it's an unfinished process. And if we can complete it, then if we can be successful in those realms, and ecological, the social, the political, it looks impossible. Like, so back to where we started in this chapter. But if we can. If this is a transitional phase, and if a sort of, new equilibrium could be reached. And it's not just going to be through our mental rationality, is part of what Aurobindo is saying, I think. It's going to be through this integration of the spiritual into materiality and into our, you know, with our rationality, certainly. Then that, you know, then it would open up many more possibilities. I'm going to share one link after this, but there's the writer, Michelle Alexander. She wrote a book called The New Jim Crow, a very political book about kind of mass incarceration of African-Americans in the US. But she just posted a opinion to the New York Times, arguing that we might, if we take the idea of reincarnation potentially seriously, and she tells about an experience she had, just the kind of weird experience she had, that could give us a different frame for our politics. Because who is reincarnating? Who's going to inherit the world, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now? If we start to see ourselves as being reborn into the world that we create when we're alive, that would totally change how we do politics and how we organize our society. So just the fact that that's coming into the New York Times is exciting to me. And I'm going to share it.
Thank you. And I know we're running late, but I'm a little more hopeful now, because I was such a Luddite a few months ago and really down on artificial intelligence. But if artificial intelligence was used in a certain way, I think that master-slave dynamic, which we are also used to, there was a time when there was a reason to have masters, because they were the ones who were in tune to the abstractions in the culture. They were the high priests and the priestesses, and they were in tune with the astrological formations and the cycles and when to plant the seeds and when to harvest. They were responsible for all that. There was a reason for their presence, and they compelled others who were not so well educated or so well informed to do the heavy lifting. But I think the artificial intelligence, if it were used in a certain way, what we're seeing is all these manufacturing jobs and are going to evaporate as these artificial intelligence are taking over all these jobs. There'll be no more cashiers. You know, they won't need them. And already you're seeing the presence of, you know, you check yourself out. It's all self-serve. And you just put your credit card in and take it out and take the receipt. So I think as it gets all automated and all these jobs disappear, there will be less reason, there'll be fewer reasons for there to be a master class. So I think that master class is as vulnerable as any other class to their success. So I think that's a very weird kind of paradox. And of course it could go in a very different way. And so our participation is going to be crucial. And which voice out of the multiplicity of voices within us and around us are we going to pay attention to? I can't wait to read that article. That sounds great.
Well, I mean, last words before Duggins?
Had fun tonight. Yeah, it's a good conversation.
We have one chapter left. The peak is within reach. It's right there.
Then we can climb down this fucking...
I'm going to ski, I think.
Thank you all.
Good night.
Night.